Welcome to the strange and unsettling world of terror at Collinwood. I am your hostess, Penny Dreadful, and I have another Dark Shadows podcast of questions and answers for you. You see, the illustrious Dale Clark, who is someone I hope to have as a guest on the podcast one of these dark and stormy nights, is best known to Dark Shadows fans as the editor and publisher of the Inside the Old House fanzine, and as the writer of some excellent Dark Shadows fan novels. Now, between 1989 and 1995, he also produced an amazing series of Dark Shadows books of questions and answers. And this podcast question and answer episode series is completely ripped off from, inspired by Dale's books. Now, before we get to this installment of the podcast, I want to let you know that voting has begun in the Rondo Hatton Classic Horror Awards, and I am very excited to announce that Terror at Collinwood has once again been nominated for Best Podcast. The show has come in second place 3 years in a row. The first time it was to Gilbert Gottfried's Amazing Colossal podcast. The second time it was to Mick Garris's Postmortem. And the third time it was to Grim Life Collective. Will the fourth time be the charm? Well, that is entirely up to you, because the Rondo Awards are like the People's Choice Awards for classic horror. So you are the one who votes for the winners. You can email your votes to taraco@aol.com, taraco@aol.com. And the complete ballot can be found at rondoaward.com. You can vote in as many or in as few categories as you like, and be sure to include your name in the email so that your vote is counted. In addition to Terror at Collinwood being nominated in the Best Podcast category, Penny Dreadful was nominated as Best Horror Host, which is an award I'm honored to have won twice. At this point in my semi-retirement in horror hosting, there are certainly others who are far more deserving of that Horror Host award than I am, but it's certainly nice to be included on the ballot. And there are many other nominees who have been on the podcast or who are friends of the podcast. For Best Independent Film, we have The Great Nick D, directed by Ansel Farage and featuring four Dark Shadows cast members and possibly a fifth one in a cameo role. And by the way, speaking of The Great Nick D, it is now available on streaming via Amazon and coming soon to more streaming platforms, so check that out. There's a link in the show notes. For Best DVD Extra, Inside the Mind of Coffin Joe, A Blind Date for Coffin Joe, which is a film by Ray Castile. Also in Best Website, Raymond Castile's Basement of Horror, which is kind of an odd place for that because Ray's show is more of a podcast or a multimedia show. It's a YouTube channel. It's a great YouTube channel. Ray was on the podcast talking about 1995 storyline. So he's nominated for two Rondo Awards. Best Graphic Arts Presentation, Sam Irvin and Dan Gallagher for Captain Samouflage and the Franken Sam Scam. You heard Sam on the podcast. We had a great conversation. Best cover, the illustrious Mark Maddox for Scream number 43. So Mark is brilliant. He got nominated. He's won several Rondo Awards and he deserved every single one of them. Best classic monster fiction, Silent, Dark, and Deep, written by Rod Labby. And Rod was also nominated for Man or Myth, the Steve Reeves story for Retro Fan Magazine. So two nominations for Rod Labby. Also in Best Monster Fiction, Ed Wood's Warm Angora Wishes and Rubber Octopus Dreams, which includes contributions by many wonderful creators, including Bobby Lugosi, George Igor Chastain, and many more. And then for Best Interview, Dr. Jeff Thompson was interviewed by Mickey Gunter for Wonder number 18. And also Diana Robertson for her interview with me in Ghastly Phantasms issue number 19. I had a great interview with Diana. She's awesome. And there was also a special Dark Shadows issue of Ghastly Phantasms. And Ghastly Phantasms itself was nominated for Best Magazine. So congrats, Diana. In addition, under Best Horror Host, you heard quite a few of these horror hosts in the Horror Host Tribute to Dark Shadows. Dr. Sarcophagi, Marlena Midnight, Dr. Dreck, Count Gore Duvall, Dr. Gangrene, Halloween Jack, the Zombie Cheerleader, the Bone Jangler, Carlos Boerloff, Bobby Gemonster, all were in that episode and they are all nominated on the ballot. And of course, you can write in many more as well. And of course, for Best Podcast, we have the Diecast Movie Podcast hosted by Steve Turek. We have the Classic Horrors Club, which is hosted by Jeff Owens and Rich Chamberlain. And you heard Steve Turek and Jeff Owens on Terror at Collinwood. We talked about the Monsters of Dark Shadows. Both of their podcasts are nominated. Bride of Monster Kid Radio, the revived Monster Kid Radio, hosted by Derek M. Cook and his wife, Beth. And then we have the Literary License podcast. Tom Hoetz was on a while back. That one is hosted by Keith Chaga. In the past, they've talked quite a bit about Dark Shadows. So there we are. We have quite a few. I apologize for anybody whose name who has been on the podcast, who I may have left off, that it was not intentional. Lots of great nominees, lots of really cool people on here, lots of friends I see on this list that I didn't name. It would take a whole episode for me to name everybody I know that I see on this list. So be sure to send in your votes to taraco@aol.com, taraco@aol.com. Be sure to put your name in the email. I think voting will end near the end of April. Now, in other news, I want to first thank Scott Blaze for this incredible gift. It's a Dark Shadows Collinwood lamp. This thing is absolutely amazing. It changes colors when you plug it in. It lights up. It's beautiful. The brilliant and thoughtful Scott kindly sent this to me as a present. Thank you so much for this incredible gift, Scott. This is unbelievably cool. If you're watching the video version of this, check it out so you can see what this thing looks like. It is just super, super cool and so wonderful and unique, and I absolutely love it. I can't wait to display this. I'm gonna find a great spot for it in my collection, and yeah, it's really cool. I wish I had like a blue whale set up. I need to have my own blue whale, because I would absolutely put this sign in my own little personal blue whale tavern. I'm definitely gonna find a spot for this. Super cool. Thank you very much, Scott. I really appreciate it. Now, as I mentioned in the last couple of episodes, the Lyndhurst Dark Shadows event is happening on July 19th and 20th. The weekend will include meet and greet sessions on Saturday and Sunday, both morning and afternoon. In attendance will be Catherine Lee Scott, Marie Wallace, Sharon Smith-Lentz, and possibly, maybe, even David Hennessy, no guarantees, but he's interested, and maybe other guests as well. The cost for the meet and greet is $40. There will also be a Cocktails at Collinwood event on Saturday evening, which is $125 and includes small bites and drinks in the mansion and on the veranda, photo opportunities with original props and furnishings, and access to the tower room will be part of the proceedings. There's an additional tour of the Sleepy Hollow Cemetery that has now been added. There will also be tours of the grounds at Lyndhurst that weekend, led by the Dark Shad Bros, Peter and DJ. So come to Lyndhurst for the 2025 Dark Shadows event on July 19th and July 20th. I'll put a link in the show notes to the tickets. Make sure you grab them, because they are going very fast. In other news, Bob Issel is accepting submissions for the Our Shadowed Past Volume 3 book. Our Shadowed Past is a gorgeous book series that features fan memories of Dark Shadows. I am honored to have been part of Volumes 1 and 2. Volume 1 is long sold out. I think there are a few remaining copies of Volume 2. You can get the digital version of Volume 1 still on Amazon. Volume 3 will also contain excerpts of an exclusive 2024 interview that Bob conducted with 1991 Dark Shadows series actress Joanna Going, who played Victoria Winters and Josette Dupre. For those who are interested in contributing your memories or a chapter or a short story, a festival memory, and or artwork for Volume 3, the deadline to do this is July 15th. 2025. If you'd like more information, or if you'd like to contribute to the book, email Bob at bobubas59@gmail.com. That's bobubas59@gmail.com. Or if you'd like to reserve a copy of the book, even if you're not contributing to it, you want to drop Bob a line to reserve your copy, because these are limited. It's based on how much interest there is in advance and how many people set aside a copy in advance, and that's about how many he ends up ordering. So you want to make sure to drop Bob a line if you want to copy this, and I definitely encourage you to contribute. The first two books are absolutely gorgeous. I mean, these are beautiful, beautiful books, glossy pages. If you want to check out the episode I did with Bob and Jeff, that was episode 86, where we talked about Our Shadowed Past Volume 2. So you can check that out to get an idea of what these books are like. And drop them a line if you would like a copy. Something else cool that you can get is a Terror at Collinwood t-shirt. These are available at the Penny Dreadful the 13th Tee Public Shop, along with Shilling Shockers t-shirts, lots of different designs by some great artists. The Terror at Collinwood ones are all by Eric Marshall, and there are going to be some new designs coming soon. Well, in a couple months, later this spring. They're done, but I'm waiting to unveil them. But yeah, we're going to have a couple new Terror at Collinwood t-shirts, two new ones, actually. But there's some great designs up there right now featuring the show's logos. Rock your Terror at Collinwood t-shirt and show your support for the podcast. I would certainly appreciate it. Another way to support the podcast directly is through the Buy Me a Coffee page, which is a donation website. And if you like the podcast and you want to make a donation, it is certainly sincerely appreciated. And I do appreciate everyone who has donated. Speaking of donating, I have one other thing to tell you about. James Storm is having a GoFundMe going on right now. He's asking for donations to support his endeavors in sharing the life and culture of Lakota artists through photography. Your donations will help James reach his goal, which is personally very important to him, and he sincerely appreciates any support that you can share with him. I'm going to put the link in the show notes to his GoFundMe page, and all the things I've just mentioned, I will put links in the show notes. That includes the Rondo Awards, the Tee Public site, the James Storm's GoFundMe page, the Cafe Press page, and the Lyndhurst event tickets page. One thing I should mention more often is our Etsy shop that we have for Penny Dreadful's Shilling Shockers. That is still up and running, and we sell DVDs of all of our seasons. We have stickers, we have a fan coven kit, and we have all kinds of other stuff. You can find all of that over on our Etsy shop, which is at etsy.com/shop/Shilling Shockers. Or if you just go to shillingshockers.com, you can just click right on through over on the store link. And with that said, let's get to the show. To hide. This podcast is fun, but there are spoilers inside. Let us now uncover the secrets of Collinwood. Questions must be answered. Question number one. Would Julia's treatments have permanently cured Barnabas? I'll let Dark Shadows associate producer George DiCenzo answer this one. This letter was dated December 17, 1968 on Dan Curtis Production stationery, and it was in response to a fan who wrote to ABC with this very same question, along with several other questions. Now, this letter was posted by Dark Shadows fan Andy Orlando in the Dark Shadows Collectors Group on Facebook several years ago. Andy acquired it for his collection at a Dark Shadows convention, and I appreciate Andy allowing me to share some quotes from this letter, and I'm showing it in the video version of this episode as well on the screen. So the answer to this question, per George DiCenzo, Barnabas Collins is a vampire. Any cure that is effective for him can only be temporary, and at any time, he may well revert back to his vampire state. He also responds to another related question. For ways to cure a vampire, I suggest you look for books on the occult in your library. Okay, so when we're dealing with a medical attempt to cure a supernatural curse, this is something that simply cannot succeed long term. Even with Dr. Lang's sped-up version of the cure prior to the Adam experiment, Barnabas begins to revert. Remember, he starts getting the cravings for blood, and we hear the dogs howling. In the original unused John August screenplay for the Tim Burton film, August's dialogue describes Julia's treatments as dialysis. This is the non-comedic version of the film. He describes it as dialysis, and that is exactly how I see it. These are regular, ongoing treatments that can suppress the condition, but they can never fully cure Barnabas, who is technically dead. Now, the only reason the Adam experiment worked was because it was this strange kind of metaphysical life-death double-pan balance scale kind of mad science where someone who's both dead and alive infused that which is dead with the spark of life. You have this kind of double-pan scale happening, like Barnabas is both of those things, and so is Adam, and so somehow this worked, and it drained Barnabas of the curse. It's mad science. I mean, there's no real logical explanation for this. But that was the only cure that kind of took, I would say, because it drained Barnabas of the curse and infused something that was dead with the spark of life. It animated Adam because Barnabas was dead and he himself was animated with a form of life. That worked, but it was, of course, the curse was returned to him by Jeb Hawks. Incidentally, the idea of a scientist trying to cure a vampire comes right out of Universal Horror in 1945's House of Dracula with Dr. Edelman attempting to cure Count Dracula. And of course, that did not work. So any long-term cure for Barnabas, Julia's treatments would suppress the curse. It would not completely cure Barnabas. It would be like dialysis. She would have to keep injecting him. And it's unclear whether that would work long-term. It might start to wear off. In long term, we don't know that, but it would not eliminate it. In other words, this is a supernatural curse. So medical treatments are not going to eliminate the curse. Okay, this one is inspired by our recent Dynamite Comics discussion. When Barnabas is in his coffin during the day, is he asleep? Can he be awakened? No, he's dead. Barnabas is dead during the day. Like David says in episode 326, he tells Vicky that Barnabas is dead, and Vicky says, David, you know as well as I do that Barnabas isn't dead. And David says, but he isn't dead all of the time, just some of the time. You know, people should listen to that kid. Something tells me he knows what he's talking about. Vampires are dead during the day. Now, of course, there are 1,000 different interpretations of the legends and lore, but in Dark Shadows and in many classic horror films and stories, during the day, the vampire is not asleep. It's not a little nap that they're taking during the day. You can't wake them up and talk to them. They're dead. Now remember, when Julia hypnotized Vicky and showed her Barnabas in his coffin in episode 346, do you remember what he looked like? He had that ghastly green pallor. You know why? Because he's dead during the day. The coffin isn't a bed for daytime nappy time, okay? Vampires are preternaturally tethered to the grave because they are the living dead. They must return to the safety of their coffins before the sun rises or they will be destroyed. And once they get into their coffins and the sun rises, they die. Every day, they die in their coffins. Symbolically, the coffin represents the vampire's undead nature and ties them back to their deceased state. Now, as part of their supernatural nature, the vampire's immensely powerful will is still innately in effect over its thralls. Not consciously, but it's still there, mystically emanating from them. In fact, according to Willy, during the day, Barnabas's power over him is even stronger than it is at night, which is crazy, right? Now, as dusk approaches, the vampire's unnatural life, their spark of life, slowly begins to return. Even before they can actually rise, they gain awareness as sunset nears, and then they can summon their victim, their thrall, to their coffin, even if they're not yet fully able to rise from the coffin themselves. And we saw Dirk Wilkins do this in episode 776. So no, in that comic, in Dynamite Comics, when Quentin runs to the old house and is talking to Barnabas in his coffin during the day, and then Barnabas, throws his coat over his head and runs around outside during the day, No, Barnabas is dead during the day. And it's not his little bed where he goes during the day for a comfy nap. It's the coffin he's tethered to because he is undead. Moving on. I'm salty today. I think this is going to be the new tone for Terror at Collinwood. Salty Penny Dreadful. Salty Penny Dreadful, who's cranky and old and just going to complain about everything. Next question. How does Laura Collins work? Okay, so we know Laura is a supernatural phoenix who is reborn over and over and over again. And she's driven above all else to immolate herself and her children in fire at the end of her phoenix cycle. So there are two phases to each Laura incarnation, and we know of several of them. Laura Murdoch Stockbridge, who died in 1767, Laura Stockbridge Collins, who died in 1785, Laura Murdoch Radcliffe, who died in 1867, Laura Murdoch Collins, who died in 1896, and then Laura Murdoch Collins, who died in 1966. So these are different, and this is the first death, I would say, you know, in her first stage for each of these. So there's the quote-unquote human phase of Laura, where she appears to be a human being. This is what I see as her caterpillar phase. In this phase, she functions and lives as a human and is able to conceive and bear children. So during this phase, it's quite possible that Laura isn't even fully aware of the fact that she's a phoenix. And it's also quite possible that she's unaware of her previous incarnations. I do believe she has flashes and glimpses of these things, however. And I think that's why the human version of Laura tends to be described as a very troubled and disturbed individual. Remember, the present-day Laura had been locked up in a mental hospital. She was an alcoholic. She was mentally ill. She was dealing with a lot of issues. She was a troubled individual. And I suspect that the human version of Laura isn't completely aware of her supernatural phase. I think she has flashes of it, however. I think there are images that flash into her mind where she's aware of it to some extent, but not fully. So inevitably, this caterpillar incarnation of the phoenix is always burned alive when the time comes. Whether that's set in motion by the Egyptian god Ra or not is unclear, but it happens every time. It's at this point that Laura enters her cocoon phase, what I call her cocoon phase. That is, her charred remains and ashes are the cocoon. And from this cocoon, the final butterfly form, the full-blown phoenix, reconstitutes and emerges. Remember, the body disappears after a while. When they open the coffin, there's no more charred body and ashes. They're gone, right? It reconstitutes itself. So these charred remains are sort of a cocoon, right? And from this cocoon, we get this reconstituted, full-blown phoenix form of Laura. And in this stage, Laura is in her full, back-from-the-dead, supernatural stage with complete knowledge of what she is and memories of all her prior incarnations restored. And note that her personality is markedly different in this stage as opposed to her troubled caterpillar stage. People remark on this as well, like she acts different now. There's something like spacey and weird about her now compared to how she was before. She was kind of a wild child before. She's different now. This ongoing cycle where she goes through these stages, this continues for all time. And it's unknown whether Laura can ever actually be stopped permanently. We don't know, if in a few decades Laura comes back again. She probably will. I mean, surely she will. There must be other incarnations of Laura after 1967. Laura is a trippy creature. Like there is nothing like Laura really in, I mean, of course the phoenix comes from mythology, but it's a reimagining of that mythological creature, a complete reimagining with elements of that creature infused into the Dark Shadows character, right? But this is, they've made up a lot of new and interesting elements to this character. So it's a really fascinating and unique thing in Dark Shadows. And if we look at all of Dark Shadows, which, let's face it, I mean, a lot of Dark Shadows is derived from existing source material from Gothic literature and cinema. But Laura is very unique. There are elements of H. Rider Haggard's She in Laura too. Those are kind of like more like echoes, I would say. It's not a very direct parallel. Very unique, interesting character. Okay, next question. Was Barnabas destroyed at the end of House of Dark Shadows? No. He was defeated, yes, but destroyed? Am I the only one who watched the post-credits scene? Why does nobody talk about this? As the credits end, Barnabas's body is enveloped in mist, and he turns into a bat, then flies off, squeaking into the night, as shocking Dark Shadows cliffhanger music plays. You know what that means? That's a cliffhanger. That means he's not dead. So how the heck did Barnabas survive what my friend Rick Rebello, when he was on the podcast, he referred to it as one of the most legit vampire stakings ever captured on film? I agree. It absolutely is one of the most legit vampire stakings ever captured on film. But let's take a look at human anatomy. And again, for the video version, I'm going to put up some images here. Look at some pictures of how Barnabas was staked. Willie shoves the arrow from the crossbow into his back, and then Jeff Clark pushes it through. Okay. The stake that he gets impaled with doesn't fully pierce Barnabas's heart. Instead, it kind of slices his heart at the outer edge. It catches the aorta and the lung. And I think it mostly pierced his lung. I don't think it completely pierced his heart. I think it sliced the outer edge of his heart. And I circled the image here on this chart of the human chest. And you can see where I think it hit based on where you see the arrow sticking out of his chest in the movie. It needed to be lower to really actually go through the heart. What I'm saying is it damaged him, it wounded him and incapacitated him because it did damage his heart, but it didn't pierce his heart, okay? So it incapacitated him long enough for Maggie and Jeff to get away, but it didn't destroy him because it didn't pierce his heart. If it didn't hit his heart, it didn't hit him. And you know that from the show too. So stepping outside the movie itself, I always talk about within the context of the story, but we're just going to step outside of that this time. There's no way they were going to really off Barnabas. They were going to bring Jonathan Frid back for the sequel. We know this. And Jonathan Frid didn't want to do it. So they weren't going to kill Barnabas off. Now, the rumor is that the sequel would have been the 1795 story. And I've heard this over the years. I remember Ansel Farage talking about it a while back. The Dark Shad Bros have recently been talking about it. And that makes complete sense. I've heard this a few times, and it totally makes sense. But I'm sure it would have had parts in the film that were set in the present with flashbacks to the past. In other words, I'm sure that Barnabas would have been extant in the present day. I'm sure we wouldn't have just had Barnabas as a past character, in other words. I'm sure he would have been in the present as well. But anyway, regardless of whatever sequel was planned, he turns into a freaking bat at the end of the movie. His body disappears and he turns into a bat. Now, I think some people may see this as some kind of symbolic thing, like his vampire spirit flies off in death or something. Come on, get out of town. Get out of here. You heard the cliffhanger music just like I did. And you have to wonder if Maggie and Jeff actually made it out at the end after all, because everybody else got killed. He probably went after Maggie and Jeff and offed them too. So no, Barnabas was not destroyed at the end of the film. I mean, I know that's anticlimactic because it is kind of an epic vampire staking. I mean, I get it. But no, he turns into a bat at the end with cliffhanger music. He's squeaking off into the night. They missed the heart with the stake. It grazed the heart, but it didn't pierce it. Case closed. Next question. Where were Gerard's pirates in 1840? Well, we did not see them in 1840. During the events of 1840, they were still presumably aboard the Java Queen. In the original run of events in 1840, prior to the arrival of Barnabas, Julia, and Professor Stokes, prior to their interference in the timeline, things played out very differently. Things in the summer of 1970 very much do not line up with what we see in 1840. There are a few things that line up, but very few things. Most of it does not line up. So they changed things dramatically in 1840. We saw on Gerard's gravestone, which was inscribed with the epitaph, "In darkness he did live and die," which I love. That's one of the best epitaphs in Dark Shadows. "In darkness he did live and die," that he died sometime in 1841. Also, we know that in the original unaltered sequence of events, Gerard slash Judah succeeded in killing Quentin I, Tad, and Carrie. He also seems to have succeeded in enlisting Daphne into his coven, and he got involved with her as well, because Hallie has a flash of one of Carrie's memories of seeing them kissing, and then she died as well. So at some point in the summer of 1841, in the unaltered version, we go into 1841, in his guise as Gerard, Judah must have summoned the scurvy pirate crew and brought the Java Queen to Collinsport. As Julia learns in episode 1089, and she reads from this book she finds in the Collinwood Library, on Thursday, the 27th day of August in the year 1841, the Java Queen, notorious scavenger of the seas, was caught in a storm off the rock-bound coast of Maine near the fishing village of Collinsport. Her crew of 23 brigands and cutthroats perished at sea. For years, it was believed that her infamous captain, whose identity was never known, survived the wreckage and vowed to unite his evil followers in death, causing them to rise from their graves to kill and plunder once more. The drowned pirates were obviously recovered from the sea in 1841 and buried in Collinsport in the fenced-off area in the cemetery reserved for criminals and misfits during the original run of events, because we saw them rise from their graves on land in 1970 when they were raised as zombies by the ghost of Gerard slash Judah. The pirates died at sea. Gerard slash Judah lived a little bit longer because he wrote a note saying that just as in times of yore, they would be called upon when the flag, the green flag, is waved, because that's probably how Gerard slash Ivan Miller would summon his pirates from some window somewhere or something. And Judah knew that, and that's how he would summon them from death as well. Now, I'm guessing those pirates in 1841 noticed a distinct change in Gerard's personality, especially since he most likely had them engaging in occult-related behaviors, because at this point he's possessed by Judah. He's probably having them engage in occult-related behaviors and activities. In the altered version of 1840, however, things went in a completely different direction, and the presence of Barnabas and then Angelique resulted in Gerard's death at Quentin and Desmond's witch trial, and the destruction of Judah's head as well happened. So in this altered version of the timeline, the pirates were never summoned to Collinsport. But in the original unaltered version of 1841, the pirates did come to Collinsport for whatever reason. Gerard slash Judah decided, I need the pirates here. He wanted them there for some purpose. I mean, entire episodes of the podcast could be devoted to speculation about how the original versions of 1840, 1897, and 1795 might have played out. I think 1795 was similar. I think there were different twists and turns in 1795, but I think it was close. 1897, I think most of it was similar until we get to Quentin's death. I think it was majorly different with the whole werewolf thing and how that ended. And I've talked about that before on the podcast. And 1840, I think, was hugely different. I think there were significant differences in 1840 in the original run of events. Okay, so, but that could be fun. I don't know if people would be interested in that kind of episode. I don't know, I think it would be groovy to kind of dive into that and have some fun with it. Okay, spackling continuity errors is one thing, but how do you explain bloopers like stagehands accidentally appearing on camera? Stagehands? What do you mean, stagehands? Have you seen Collinwood? Have you spent any time in the old house? Those are ghosts. Those mansions are the poster children for haunted houses. They're ghosts. Of course they're ghosts. In one instance, in fact, it's clear that one of the spirits was clairvoyant because it knew what Bethia Mapes was going to say before she actually said it. Now, that might have been an inhuman entity, because Collinwood had only been recently built, but there may have been some spirits haunting that land itself. Or it could have been a spirit of one of the workers that Joshua and Jeremiah employed to help build Collinwood. Maybe they died building Collinwood. Maybe they're one of the first ghosts to haunt Collinwood. But something knew what Bethia Mapes was going to say before she said it. We heard it, even if the people in the room didn't hear it. Next question. Okay, fine, they're ghosts, but how do you explain the cameras, boom mics, and mic shadows that accidentally show up in some of the shots? What in the world are you talking about? Those are incomprehensible beings, unseen by the inhabitants of Collinsport. Are they creatures of the underworld? Are they interdimensional entities? Are they demonic in nature, sent by Diabolos to watch and report back? Or are they benevolent, sent by a higher power to observe but not interfere? These are beings that even we were not meant to see, and yet somehow we do. You know, These question and answer episodes have gone too far now. We weren't supposed to ask about those creatures. And now that we've brought them up, I know we're all going to start seeing them. Out of the corner of your eye. Don't look, don't look, don't look, don't look. I don't want to look, I don't want to look. I know I'm going to see one. I don't want to see one. Oh, I see.
We are experiencing operating difficulties. Please stand by.
And the podcast has officially jumped the shark. I'd ask you to consider voting for Terror at Collinwood in the Rondo Awards, but no, I'm not going to ask you to consider doing that, but you may consider voting for someone else in the Rondo Awards. There are many categories to consider and many other podcasts that are not insane. Anyway, thank you so much for listening. If you stuck with me this long, you sure are a champ. Look out for those things you think are cameras and microphones. They're not. And I hope that you will join me for the next episode of Terror at Collinwood. Lots of great stuff coming up, so stay tuned. And for as long as they lived, the dark shadows never truly vanished, for there will always be Terror at Collinwood. Terror at Collinwood is a Penny Dreadful production.